a little bit about superstring theory and give you a flavor for what's going on. As you saw in the last transparency and on this transparency, string theory has made it into the popular culture. Certainly if you're getting cartoons in the New Yorker magazine, it must be an interesting topic. There have even been a number of books written on the topic. Some of them who think that string theory is the greatest thing since the invention of white bread. Other people have less favorable opinions. But I just want to, certainly all of this attention comes because string theory is sort of at the cutting edge of theoretical physics and science as we know it today. But to start today's story, I want to put it in perspective. If we're at the cutting edge of physics at the 21st century, it builds on a lot of interesting physics that was discovered in the 20th century. And so we saw enormous progress in the last century. And one of the most striking features, which I'm trying to illustrate here, is how very diverse topics, or what we're seeing as very diverse, different topics in physics, theoretical physics, were actually brought together, and there was a synthesis of these ideas and how new ideas grew out of that synthesis. And so to really illustrate what I mean by those fancy words, I want to look at the top little bit of this diagram. So there we've got thermodynamics and electromagnetism, and those are words that are familiar to all of you, I'm sure. Thermodynamics, well, what's that about? You know, that was actually the string theory, well, perhaps not the string theory, that was cutting edge physics and engineering of the 19th century. It propelled society and invention at the time, and it gave us steam engines, it gave us factories, new sources of power. At about the turn of the century, at the same time, people were fooling around with magnets and circuits, and we discovered radio waves and all of that, and that comes under the topic of electromagnetism. Now, the arrows here, though, are saying that somehow these two topics come together. So where do radio waves and steam engines come together? Well, the idea is actually one that's familiar to all of us. If you heat something up enough, it glows. That glowing is actually electromagnetic radiation. And what people found is that there were beautiful theories to describe this and beautiful theories to describe this, but when you tried to put them together to describe this situation where hot things were glowing, there were certain inconsistencies. And to resolve those inconsistencies, ultimately what happened is people had to invent a new kind of physics, quantum mechanics. And that's really where quantum theory came from. And of course, as we all know, that discovery led to remarkable new understandings of matters and material, electronics, and gave rise to new enormous progress in the way we, in our society today. So that's sort of an inkling of the kind of ideas that are coming together here. Here there are other topics. This is something to do about the symmetries of the laws of nature. We found that we had to extend the symmetries of the laws of nature. Here's gravity and that coming together. Quantum theory and special relativity coming together. And at the end of the 20th century, theoretical physics really rested on two cornerstones or two pillars here, general relativity and something that I'm calling quantum field theory, which was grown out of quantum mechanics. So what are those two topics really about? Well, general relativity, it's all about gravity. So this was really the invention of Einstein. The first thing he realized in the early 1900s was that people thought about space in one way, that's the directions we move in, it's something we measure with rulers. Time was thought of as being completely different, it's something we measure with our watches. And so what do rulers have to do with watches? Well, what he realized was that, in fact, in the same way that we have conversion constants that take us from centimeters to inches or inches to miles, nature gave us a conversion constant that took us between miles over here and time or seconds over here, and that's the speed of light. And in playing with those ideas, he realized that space and time are not completely separate, but they're inextricably linked. And he really invented a new idea to combine those two. He invented a geometric idea called space-time. Going a little bit further, he realized this is a geometric object or a geometric structure, but geometries are more interesting than just, you know, planes here or pieces of paper. Those pieces of paper can be curved. You can have the surface of a ball. That's something we say has positive curvature, or a saddle here, something we say has negative curvature. And so in extending these ideas about space-time, he realized that gravity is telling us, or it's a manifestation of the curvature of space-time. And so he gave this whole new geometric interpretation of this force that tells us how we fall down. That was a remarkable insight, and it was only one of many. General relativity became a source of all sorts of new ideas. We have black holes, regions of space-time with a curvature so great that light can't escape. We have the idea that we can have fluctuations or ripples in space-time that propagate, just like electromagnetic waves. And we can think about the universe as a whole, and we've seen that the universe is, in fact, lives in an expanding space-time geometry. So having remarkable new insights is a terrific property for a theory. But one of the reasons, of course, that general relativity has taken hold is that it's been rigorously tested time and time again. And so here's a list of different tests where general relativity made new predictions. Experimentalists went out, made those measurements, and found that there was an agreement between the predictions of the theory and the measurements that they made. And ultimately, well, various tests are going on today, but the pinnacle of all of that comes in 1993. Two gentlemen, Hulse and Taylor, actually won a Nobel Prize for their very careful measurements of the orbits of two distant stars, which were called quasars and emitted very bright radio beams. And what they found was a set of measurements that said that those orbits were shifting in a very particular way. But you can see here that those measurements lie precisely on this line, which is a prediction of general relativity. That's an excellent question. I'll take it up at the end. I'll keep going here. General relativity has actually gone on beyond, and it's now actually something that actually affects or goes into products that we can go down to Costco or perhaps Walmart to buy. In fact, these little GPS units that are for sale that you can put in your car, they tell us our positions to remarkable accuracy, but in fact, these products or these GPS units would not work or would not be able to work with the accuracy that they do if they did not incorporate both the effects of special relativity and the effects of general relativity, because they rely on the synchronization of various clocks in satellites that are orbiting around the Earth. And so both the position of the satellites in the gravitational field and the motion of the satellite has to be taken into account when they come up with when the signals run through various processors and come up with your position. So the bottom line here is that general relativity gives us a geometric arena or a geometric way of thinking about physics on the very largest scale. So we're talking about systems that are the size of planets or stars, galaxies, or the whole universe itself, which comes under the topic of cosmology. So what about small scales? Well, small scales is the domain then of quantum mechanics or quantum theory. And in quantum theory, we have to shift our brains a little bit. We have to set aside geometry and we start thinking in terms of statistics and probability. And what we come up with then is a very accurate theory of the behavior of small particles. And in particular, one of the ideas coming from quantum theory is the idea that particles can act like waves, also known as particle-wave duality. And so the idea is, here's a simple formula, that I can associate with a particle a wavelength, and that it's inversely proportional to the momentum of that particle. And there's some conversion constant, again, that comes out of nature. Now, I did a calculation, and you can as well with this formula. If I think about a raindrop about a millimeter in width dropping out of the sky, you can calculate the momentum, plug it into this formula, and you come up with a wavelength of 4 × 10⁻³⁰ meters. Now, I'll just remind you that's an awful lot of zeros after the decimal point and then a 4. So that's a tiny, tiny uncertainty or a tiny, tiny wavelength. And it's really not relevant when we're talking about an object like this. So we might imagine a simple experiment here where I have, well, I've called it a jet of water. Think of a hose. And I'm going to spray some screen here, and the screen has two holes in it. The distance scales that I'm talking about here, I might think in terms of centimeters. And what happens is the water either goes through that hole and makes the wall wet over here, or the water goes through that hole, makes the wall wet over there. But if I'm talking about something where the scale is centimeters, the width of my hose or the water jet, then certainly a wavelength like this is irrelevant. And so when I said small scale, centimeters is certainly not small enough. We really have to think about much smaller scales, the size of at least atoms. And so in a typical situation, you can similarly use this formula to calculate the wavelength of an electron. And what you'll come up with is, again, an impressively small number. Here we've got 3 × 10⁻¹0, but that's a number that physicists are used to dealing with. There are experiments that work at this level, and they've invented a unit. That's called an angstrom. An angstrom is a unit of distance that we're used to working with when we're talking about atoms or the wavelength of light, et cetera. And the remarkable thing is I can repeat this experiment with an electron beam over here. But now I'm not talking about objects where the size is centimeters when I'm talking about electron beams. This screen now is going to be a foil. And in fact, I can make small perforations in that foil where the distances here are of the order of angstroms. And what I will find is that even though I think of this as a beam of particles, what I see on the screen back here has a wave-like interference pattern. And that comes because this beam is actually obeying the principles of quantum theory, and there's an interference effect due to the wave-like properties. And so the scale that I'm talking about then is the atomic scale, or in fact, subatomic scale, and that's where the realm of quantum theory really comes into play. So here at 10⁻¹0 or the angstrom scale, what we see are atoms where there are clouds of electrons circling a nucleus. If we increase the resolution by 4 orders of magnitude, what we see is the details of that nucleus at the center of the atom. And what we see is that it's not just a point particle, but rather it's composed itself of other particles, namely protons and neutrons. If we increase the resolution yet again by an order of magnitude, we can see in experiments that those individual protons and neutrons are themselves composed of constituents, which we call quarks. And so today, experiments have gone down to the resolution of about 10⁻¹⁷ meters. And what we found is a whole list of different kinds of particles. There are the electrons here, but then it has cousins known as the muon, the tau particle. There's things known as the neutron or neutrinos. Up there, I talked about quarks in a proton and neutron. I found quarks that carry the names up and down. But in fact, experiments have revealed other kinds of quarks, which go by these rather curious names, strange, charm, bottom, top. On the other side here, this is really the matter in the problem. Those pieces of matter interact in different ways. There are different forces. We talked about electromagnetism early on. And in quantum theory, the force mediator is known as the boson. What keeps these quarks together is known as the strong force. The mediator there is known as the gluon. There's another force known as the weak force, which is relevant in radioactive decays, say, of the nucleus. And there are various, well, they have a less colorful names. The force mediators there are called W plus minus and the Z. In red here, I have what's known as the Higgs particle. You can ask me about it later. It's sort of a missing piece in the puzzle, but it's expected, or this picture can be brought together in a very elegant, or, well, perhaps that's an overstatement, in a consistent framework known as the standard model of subatomic physics. But there is this extra piece that we're still hunting for known as the Higgs particle. But that model doesn't just list a bunch of particles. What the model does is it says that those particles interact in very specific ways. And so there's about 20 free parameters that tell us the strength of various interactions between this zoo of particles. So for example, if I have a W here, it can decay into an electron and an electron neutrino. So that's an example of the kind of interactions that we see. Now, one of the reasons, again, that quantum theory has taken such strong hold is the remarkable testing or confirmation that we've seen in the lab. And so one of my favorite examples is the one that I've given here. If I look at an electron, one of the things we know about is that it's charged, but it's also true that in quantum theory we can understand that it, as well as carrying a charge, it carries sort of a magnetic moment. So it's a tiny little moment. Magnet. And that magnetic moment is characterized by this quantity, which is some combination of constants that we measure. And then there's this number, G, that sits in front there. The leading order, we know that G is just 2. That's a very simple answer. But because of the uncertainties or the fluctuations in the quantum theory, what happens is that G, or that 2, gets corrected. And in fact, you can go and make measurements, and you find that it's not quite 2, it's rather 2.002319. And so you can do very careful measurements and come up with a result like that. On the other hand, the theorists can also go away, struggle with their calculations, and they can come up with an answer like that. And so what you can see is that, well, these two are looking very much alike. There's a strong confirmation that the theorists can describe that experiment. If you look very, very closely down on the end, we see that there's a slight, well, the numbers start to disagree. But that disagreement is not a contradiction between the theory and the experiment. Rather, that disagreement is saying that, well, it takes a certain amount of effort to do an experiment and get an accurate result. And down here, to get better numbers here, or to get accurate, reliable numbers here, we're going to have to improve the experiment. In the same way, the theorists, to get better numbers here, to get accurate answers, are going to have to do more accurate calculations. But we're talking about orders of magnitude extra work, both on the theory side and the experimental side. And so that's where it stands now. And so the agreement is to one part in 10 to the 10, which is, again, well, by my books, it's a very impressive confirmation of quantum theory. There are other examples, certain shifts between energy levels in the hydrogen atom here. Well, not quite 10 to the minus 10, but 6 significant figures of agreement. So there is this remarkable agreement between what we see in nature and what we can calculate using the theory. Quantum theory's also, again, been a rich source of new ideas. Here's a whole list of different ideas. some of which we know may be familiar: semiconductors, superfluid superconductors, quantum Hall effect, lasers, magnetic resonance imaging. In fact, when I made this list, the place that I went was actually the Nobel Prize page. And you can just go through the Nobel Prizes in the past 100 years, and you can see all these different kinds of places where quantum theory has led to remarkable new insights into nature. And the folks in Sweden thought that those insights were worthy of assigning a prize to them. Okay, well, back to subatomic physics. This is what we have. You know, we go to higher and higher resolution. We're seeing these fundamental particles. We have this whole list. So this is where I come finally to string theory. And what string theory tries to do is say, well, rather than having this list of random particles, what the new insight is that perhaps those random particles are all different manifestations of the same thing. And so the idea is that we can combine those all together and think of them as being different manifestations of a single object, a string-like object, with when I look at them with a much greater resolution. So look, here's where we are today, but I'm telling you that I need to increase by many, many orders of magnitude, and we'll see a string, in fact, not a particle. So because I have an extended object rather than a point-like particle, it can have or it has extra degrees of freedom, and it can vibrate, it can rotate in different ways. And when it does that, the idea is that it will then, when I look at it at the resolution that we have today, that those different vibrations will manifest themselves as I see different, or particles with different physical properties. So if I changed, or if I increase the number of vibrations here, I might increase the mass. Or if I change the rotation, I might change the magnetic moment of the particle. I talked about the increased resolution that we need, though. There's a typical size that I associate with all of those strings. So there's a string scale, and as I said, it's this remarkably small number, 10 to the minus 35 meters. Well, the standard model, as well as giving us a list of particles, also told us about how those particles interact. How would strings interact? Well, it's actually a very simple idea. Two strings can come together, they would touch, and then they would reorganize the ends where they touch. So two loops have turned into one, and I'm left with a single string. Oops, I went the wrong way. So here's an animation showing that same process, but we can all do string theory with our hands here. I've got two loops. What happens is they come together and touch and open up to form a single loop. Now, of course, this is in the realm of a quantum theory, and so there's a certain probability that the two strings open up to form this single loop. There's also a probability that the strings just pass right through each other. And so there's a coupling constant in the theory, or something that we call a coupling constant, which really tells us about the probability that when they touch, either this happens or nothing happens. So what we have then is a simple theory. It has a scale that tells us the typical size of a string. And we have a coupling constant and this geometric picture of how strings interact. And so with those simple rules and a lot of extra math, what it turns out is that you have the appropriate framework where you can describe all of the different kinds of particles and the interactions that appear in the standard model. And so string theory then seems to have the potential to give us this framework that combines everything together in a single theory. And so this is, the idea is we're going to take all of this stuff and put it together in a single string theory. But then I've got a question here: what's missing? Well, what's missing is something that I talked about towards the beginning, gravity. And in quantum theory, Gravity is another force, so it belongs in this column over here, and the force mediator has the name the graviton. So one of the remarkable properties of string theory is that it's also a theory not just of quantum physics, but it's also a theory of gravitational physics. Consistency of the theory requires that a graviton appear or be a part of that theory. And in fact, if I think about string theory not at the string scale where I have little loops that are vibrating and interacting, but rather think about it at a much, much distant, longer distance scale, so at scales much bigger than this, then what comes out is a set of equations that look very much like Einstein's equations of gravitational physics. And so there's an equation that looks like this. It may not be familiar to you, but this is geometric stuff. It's telling us about the curvature of the space-time. And on this side, that T is something that tells us about the matter. And this thing here, well, that's actually something that you do know about, I hope, Newton's constant. That's the thing that appears in Newton's law. After all, this is a theory of gravity. And so this constant, which we know governs gravity here in this room, or in the solar system, that appears in this set of equations. But what this is telling us about is it's a coupling constant. It tells us about how the matter interacts with the gravitons or with the gravity. And so if this appears in string theory, I said, had rules for those interactions. And so it must have a prediction for how to describe Newton's constant. And so that's actually how I came up with the string scale. Because string theory tells us that Newton's constant is related to other constants, in particular the string scale, with this simple formula. But I know, or we've measured, what all of those constants are in nature, and so putting them together in this way gives us a distance, which is 10 to the minus 35 meters. And that's why I knew, or that's why I said I knew, how big a typical string is. If those strings are going to describe nature as we know it, then this has to be true, and the scale we're talking about is this very small one. And so the idea, the bottom line, though, is that strings naturally give us this unified framework where we bring together the quantum theory and Einstein's theory of gravity, general relativity. And so the idea is that this diagram continues to progress, and we get yet another synthesis, and the proposal is, or what string theorists are working on, is the proposal that these two theories actually will be synthesized and combined into a single framework, which is namely then the string theory, or superstring theory. Well, that's a nice idea. Of course, there's a lot more to it. And the devil is in the details, as I said here. So one of those details is that string theory predicts that we live in 10 space-time dimensions. So let's look around. Do we see 10 space-time dimensions? The answer, of course, is no. We see 3 space dimensions, and then we've got time. So that only adds up to 4. Where are the extra 6? Well, maybe they're just curled up. Maybe they're so small that we can't probe them yet, or we haven't been able to probe them yet. And so that's a big assumption, but there's enormous progress, or a lot of people have worked on these kinds of ideas where these 6 extra dimensions, rather than being very large or infinite, perhaps, as we see the 3 dimensions that we're used to, perhaps they're curled up, and you can only move distances of order the string scale. And so the analogy here is the tightrope walker. As far as she's concerned, the tightrope has 1 dimension, and she can move forward or backward. On the other hand, if there's a little bug here by her foot, he would see the tightrope perhaps as a 2-dimensional object, because he sees things on a much smaller scale. And so not only can he move forward and backward, but he can also move to the side and around the tightrope like that. One of the things that I like to emphasize is that these extra space-time dimensions are not just an extra richness that we have to hide, or an extra embarrassment that we have to hide in the theory. These are actually an essential ingredient. And so many string theorists will try and explain to you that this is an essential ingredient because of the consistency of some mathematical equation. But the way I would want to present it to you is that it's essential if we're going to describe physics in our universe or in nature as we see it, then we had to have a string theory with extra space-time dimensions or something else equivalent to that. Because what I described string theory as was a theory with one scale and one coupling constant. But if you look around in nature, you see that there's different physics on all sorts of different scales. When I listed the different forces, it was a whole slew of different forces, and they all have different coupling constants. And so this is a technical way. This graph is some physicist's way, a French physicist's way, in fact, of describing that fact. But it's just something that's common sense. Nature, as we know it, has all sorts of different interesting scales, all sorts of interesting different coupling constants. String theory has, I said, at the most fundamental level, a single scale, a single coupling constant. And so all of this richness then comes from engineering those extra dimensions, or changing the ways we curl the extra six dimensions up. And so it's changing our perspective on how we have to come to grips with this picture here, on how we have to come to grips with that complex physics. But rather than adding extra forces or adding extra particles to our theory, what we do is we're supposed to ask a geometric question and ask, how can we curl up our six dimensions to produce physics that looks like this? Okay, another detail. Well, string theory predicts that there are lots of extra particles which we haven't seen yet. In particular, the super in superstring theory comes from something known as supersymmetry. It says that for every fermion, so those were the particles in the first column of the standard model, there should be a boson, so those were the particles in the second column, with the same physical properties. So here I said the same mass, but the same mass, charge, spin, all of the different physical properties should be the same. And yet if you go back and look and compare the two columns, the particles appearing in the column of fermions and bosons look very different. And so this symmetry simply isn't seen or manifest in nature. Of course, the solution is, well, maybe we better look harder, that's all. Maybe we haven't seen these particles yet. Maybe they're there, but for various reasons, this symmetry is broken in nature. We already have examples of broken symmetries, and so the vacuum we live in doesn't manifest this symmetry, but it means that the particles are there, but they're there at heavier masses. One of the benefits, one of the reasons that string theorists like supersymmetry is because it's essential in producing a theory that's where the quantum theory and gravity are consistent. And in fact, supersymmetry is an essential seems to be an essential ingredient in taming the quantum fluctuations at the shortest distance scales, at the distance scales where gravity and strings become manifest or become important.
Same charge, the same amount as the fermion.
Yeah, well, actually, it doesn't have the same spin, but it's supposed to have the same charge.
So there will be a difference just in the spin?
Yeah. I went too quickly. If I have a spin and a half fermion, then it depends on the theory, but it may have a partner that's either a spin zero or a spin one. The difference is always by one half. So go up or down.
Can I ask one other question?
Yeah.
Perhaps we should look harder, but what do you mean by harder? Is it a technical question? More energy in the accelerator?
More energy in the accelerator. I'll come back to that in a moment. But if I don't satisfy you, you should bugging about that towards the end.
Another detail. This is more so. So the other two are obvious. If you like flaws with the theory as we understand it. I mean, we observe certain things in nature, and these properties of the theory don't correspond to what we observe. And so we have to, as theorists, understand the theory better. We have to manipulate the extra dimensions, or we have to understand how a symmetry is broken. The last one here, this detail that I want to talk about, is a very interesting one, but it's more an aesthetic issue. It's not really a conflict with an experimental observation. Here, the issue is that I said that I had a framework to describe the unification of quantum theory and gravity in a single theoretical framework. On the other hand, in fact, if I go and look at a string theory textbook, there are actually five different ways to combine gravity and quantum theory in a superstring theory, or rather, we have what seem to be five different superstring theories. But if we're going to describe nature, well, we only have one universe, so don't we have four too many theories up there? Well, in fact, what people, as they've come to understand, as the theorists have come to understand string theory and develop string theory further, what it appears is that these theories that we thought of, or that have made it to the textbooks and appeared to be different theories, it seems that they're all different manifestation or different phases of a single underlying framework. And that framework just goes by the name M-theory. I can't really tell you what the M stands for, and so we'll just call it the mysterious theory. But how did people come to this conclusion? Well, there are two essential ingredients, and I'll try and give you a flavor for both of those. The first is dualities. So that's a nice buzzword that you'll read about perhaps in a popular book about string theory. But it's basically a fancy way of saying that I might have two different sets of mathematics, but those two different sets of mathematics are actually describing the same physics. So physics and mathematics, those may seem like strange concepts, but certainly it's something that we're used to in our everyday. We can have two different languages, say Dutch or English, and use different words to describe the same world that we see around us. It's just that there has to be a dictionary between those two different frameworks. And so this is just extending this multilingualism to mathematics and theoretical physics. And so here's an example, something known as T-duality. And it's something that relates string theories on large and small circles. So I want to describe the physics. So I'm going to take, remember, those extra dimensions and curl them up. So let's curl one of our extra dimensions up on a circle. And I'll say the circumference of that circle is 2 pi r. Now I'm going to pick another circle because I know the answer. I'm going to curl it up on a small circle, and I'm going to give it a circumference that's now given by some combination of the string scale and this r here. But if this r is big, then string scale squared over a big number is going to give us a very small circumference on this side. Now, if I'm doing quantum theory, I recall that particles had wavelengths. If I have a particle then that's moving around in this circle, essentially in the same way that you might have heard about orbits around an atom, I'm going to need an integer's worth of wavelengths for the particle to move around the circle. Otherwise, I get destructive interference and the motion of the particle collapses. So on this side, if I want an integer number of wavelength, I'm going to associate at high energies the momentum and the energy. But if I want an integer number of wavelengths, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to get a relation between the energies of the particles that I see and the radius here. And so let's see if this works. Yeah. So I get a spectrum of different energies that are basically given by an integer divided by the radius. I do the same calculation over here. Again, an integer divided by the radius, but that radius was this combination of variables over here. So if I was doing particle physics, I was only talking about particles, that would be the end of the story. I'd look at this, I'd look at that, I'd say they're different, it's different physics. However, string theory lets us do something else. String theory, I've got extended objects. Here I've got a circle, so what I can do is I can take my string and wrap it around or wind it around the extra dimension. I didn't get a picture, oh well. So I can imagine wrapping my string around the circle many, many times. The energy that will come out of that is the number of times that I wrap, the circumference of the circle, and then the tension or the energy density of the string. So I plug the numbers in. Here's the circumference of my circle. The energy density of the string is again related to the string scale. Remember, I said there's only a single scale in the theory. And so I put the numbers together and I get that. And what comes out then is that the winding modes of the string give me a spectrum where I have an integer times r divided by ls squared. Over here, I did the same set of math, and now I got an integer divided by capital R, and the ls is canceled out. And so this is different than this. Okay, but if we step back, instead of comparing this and this, let's compare this and this. Wait a minute, those two are exactly the same formula. Let's compare that and that. Well, again, those two are the same formula. So it seems that as far as the physics is concerned, I'm getting the same spectrum of strings on this theory, or this circle and this circle. It's just that I can't call the momentum modes over here, the momentum modes over here. Rather, what I'm told to do is I should compare the momentum modes here with the string winding modes over here. And similarly, the winding modes over here get compared with the momentum modes on that side. So that's a, well, there may have been a lot of formulas there, but the idea is, and this is just the tip of the iceberg, but in fact, when I do this in string theory, I find that the interactions and the spectrum of the theory on a circle of this size, this large circle, is identical to the string theory over here. So the physics works out the same, even though the mathematics, I mean, large, small circles, the place that I started looked very different. So that was dualities. The other ingredient was that we found out that string theory is not just a theory of strings. Rather, there are other objects. I said that we had strings which are extended in one dimension. Well, in fact, if you play with certain versions of the theory, you find that an essential ingredient, or consistency again, gives you objects that are extended in any number of dimensions. So I can have particles again, things that aren't extended. I can have strings extended in one dimension. I can have things extended in two dimensions. Those are called membranes. In general, they're extended in some number of dimensions, and we give that number of dimensions a label P. And so some very creative physicists came up with the name here, P-brains. Why didn't I set out at the beginning and talk about a theory of P-brains rather than a theory of strings? Well, it turns out that in the regime that we were typically working, we had this coupling constant. And to understand the strings, they were weakly interacting so that I could do simple math. Turns out that the energy densities associated with these objects here combine both the string scale and this coupling constant. And so when in the regime where we had been working before, implicitly I'd been working before, that this was very small, these energy densities were huge. And so they didn't contribute very much in the theory. So at weak coupling, I have very heavy objects. But you can imagine that it's also interesting to study the theory at strong coupling, where this number gets to be of order one, where the probability is that the strings are always interacting every time they touch. And it turns out then that now, if this is becoming large, then the energy density here is becoming small. And so in that regime, these objects start to play a more and more important role and, in fact, become an essential ingredient of describing the physics. And so by playing with dualities and this idea of D-brains, which become important in various different regimes, what people have done is they've put together the pieces of the puzzle, and all of these theories that were thought of as being different string theories actually can be connected by various kinds of duality. Now, the astute observer may have noticed that before I was talking about five different string theories, but I put up this pretty picture that has six different corners. That's because there's this extra corner up here that isn't even a string theory, and it isn't in 10 dimensions. In fact, it's an 11-dimensional theory. And it's a corner of the theory that is the least well understood, but these dualities, these connections, hint that there's some other phase of the theory out here that actually looks like it contains 11 dimensions. So this is an example, then, that string theory has been a source of new ideas, new mathematical ideas. And perhaps then, rather than saying I'm going to get a synthesis to produce string theory here, I should say that what we're seeing is a synthesis that's going to produce this M theory, which is the underlying framework. But how are we going to really prove that? Well, up here I talked about how, in fact, we could see where these two theories came together, and it came together when we saw things glow. The technical name there is blackbody radiation. And in fact, all of these different steps in the synthesis that we saw in the 20th century came really, or an essential ingredient in that synthesis was the either inspiration or the prodding of some experimental fact or the confirmation by some other observed or experiment. Here we have these two beautiful theories, which I said were rigorously tested in the laboratory or in astronomical observations to remarkable precision. And as theorists, we can understand exactly where there's going to be inconsistencies or where the theory starts to fall apart. And it's at this scale known as the Planck scale, or this length scale that came out of that special combination of constants, which I called the string scale. And so these two theories are, well, in a as theorists, we think that these two theories are going to fail, but they're only going to fail when I'm trying to describe physics at 10 to the minus 35 meters. Now, in our experiments, we just can't access. We don't have microscopes or experiments that take us down to 10 to the minus 35 meters. So string theory is a beautiful idea. But what's it good for? How can we really make progress? Well, in different ways, we're trying to make contact with experiments. And so, you know, one of the ideas is we have to go to shorter distance scales. So we need to build accelerators, but we need to build accelerators with higher and higher energies. There is this beautiful experiment that hopefully will be running later this year called the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. And it'll probe, or it'll open up a new energy frontier in particle physics. And if you ask theorists there what, or experimentalists there, what they're looking for, well, one possibility is that they're looking for extra dimensions. Turns out there are scenarios, or theoretical scenarios, where those extra dimensions aren't really as small as I had discussed earlier. The reason you can get away with that is because perhaps the fields or the particles that we know about in the standard model are actually confined to one of these brains that I talked about. And it's only the gravitons, the stuff that tells us about space-time geometry, that really feels the full 10 dimensions. And so you can put together a consistent theoretical framework, but in that framework, the extra dimensions aren't, you know, of the order of the string scale. Rather, they can be of the order of, you know, angstroms or even millimeters, perhaps. And in those scenarios, we would start to see the effects of those extra dimensions already at LHC energy. So this is just some formulas that are telling us that the Planck scale that I talked about in four dimensions may not actually be the Planck scale that enters in the string theory. And so if you, so I said one of the things they're going to be looking for is the extra dimensions. Another, of course, is supersymmetry or these missing superpartners. Another way to go is by looking out at the large universe by doing cosmological experiments. The idea here is that one of the ideas we have is that as we move in time, the universe is expanding. And in fact, things are cooling down. So instead, if I run backwards in time, that means that the universe was smaller and smaller, and things were hotter and hotter at earlier stages of the universe. So if I go far enough back into time, perhaps I can reach a regime where strings were manifest, or there were little, you know, loops and vibrating strings that were running around. And that's the way that we would describe physics here. We have this big microscope, namely the universe itself, and we have to understand the optics, but perhaps there are remnants or imprints of this stringy physics that we see here in the universe today. And so one of those might be a relic string, namely perhaps there was a string here that got caught up in the expansion of the universe and is now a string that stretches out across the sky, and perhaps we could see it in some experimental observation. But it may be also that there are subtle imprints of that stringy physics in, well, what I'm showing here is the cosmic microwave background, some radiation from the earliest stages of the universe. So we're working hard. I mean, I think this is one of the key industries or initiatives in string theory is how do you make contact between that microscopic world at the physics at the Planck scale and physics that we can access today, physics on a macroscopic scale. Another aspect of string theory is the mathematics, though. I've hinted at that several times in the talk, that there's a lot more to it than I'm giving on you today. And in fact, string theory draws upon an enormous range of modern mathematics. And in fact, there's been a very fruitful interplay between the physicists and the mathematicians in developing some of these new ideas in mathematics. And so here's just a list of buzzwords of different kinds of mathematics that appear to have some relation to string theory. But just like when I talked about the standard model, there was a list of particles. Here there's a list of different kinds of mathematics. And so what that's really indicating is that we don't yet have the right language for string theory. It's as though we're trying to invent Einstein's general relativity, but we don't yet know about geometry. We have a lot of amazing tools, but none of them seems to be the right tool to describe this new physical theory of strings. And so the analogy that I'd like to make is that, you know, we're working on this big puzzle here, and we've identified little pieces, and we can understand what's going on with these pieces. We may even understand how different pieces fit together, but what's really missing is what's the big picture? How does this all fit together in one hopefully elegant framework to describe the physics that we want to describe? And so this is actually what I would say is the other major source of progress, or is going to be the other source of progress, is developing the mathematics, or developing perhaps a new mathematics to describe this new kind of physics, remember, this is a very ambitious new theory that's trying to describe physics both at the cosmological or the largest length scales that we know about in nature, and also the smallest length scales that we know about in nature. Perhaps not surprising that we need to develop a new language or a new kind of mathematics. So I started the talk by talking a little bit about the history of physics, and so I'll end with another analogy or another little bit of history. And it's perhaps hard for us to remember, but in the early 1900s, at the beginning of the 20th century, there was a debate raging amongst physicists or scientists, some of the brightest minds of the day, and the debate was about whether or not atoms existed or whether or not we should even bother to think about theories where atoms were some basic constituents of matter. And so one of the leading thinkers said that, you know, developing theories with atoms was a useless theoretical enterprise because atoms are things that are never going to be, we're never going to be able to physically verify the existence of these objects. And so that developing theories like that wasn't doing physics. However, in fact, this gentleman turned out to be wrong. Less than 100 years later, not only does every school child know about atoms, not only have we confirmed that there are, that nature or the underlying constituents of matter is atoms, we're able to actually manipulate those atoms one by one. And so in this picture here, what people have done is they've actually put together an ellipse formed by individual atoms. Each of these bumps in this profile of electron density is an individual atom on a surface, and then they put another atom at the focus of that ellipse, and the experiment is just to see this effect here. If this atom appears at the focus of the ellipse, then there's some interesting physics or bump that appears in the profile at the other. But the idea is that in a very short time, we've come from a time of where the theorists were at the fore to a time where the experimentalists can actually work with these, well, mystical objects up here on an individual basis. And so for superstring theorists, I think we're still in the very early days. We're, you know, involved in a very ambitious enterprise, but I'll leave you with the idea that the adventure is still only beginning. And if you're interested in other sources of information, well, the web is the source of all information. And so here are some interesting places you can go to find or to learn a little bit more about string theory. And this is, I think, off the official string theory website. It says that it's the 21st century time to feed your brain. And so with that, I'll conclude and thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much for that presentation. Does anyone have any questions? Jason.
You talked about the need for new mathematics or at least a new mathematical model with that. How do you find the collaboration between the theoretical physics community and the mathematicians, the mathematical community? There would have to be a whole lot of overlap there. Or do you find new experts being formed that have very strong skills in both areas?
There certainly is, but the thing to remember is that it's a very broad field. I mean, I was talking about cosmology, mathematics, particle physics. So there are interactions with cosmologists and you know, particle physicists, which may seem more natural because I call myself a theoretical physicist, but there are also strong interactions with mathematicians. And so some of the brightest string theorists are actually closely allied with, mathematics departments and mathematicians. And there's enormous interest because, you know, a lot of new ideas, such as mirror symmetry, were sort of, those are ideas in mathematics. And they were inspired by, you know, things that string theorists found. I'm being a little bit glib, but the string theorists were fooling around with these six-dimensional geometries, trying to, you know, understand how to produce interesting physics. But they observed interesting patterns. And actually, you know, you could do very detailed calculations, and that inspired the mathematicians to develop sort of a whole new field or an understanding of the geometry, given those hints from the string theorists. And of course, the string theorists can then take that and apply it and sort of, you know, catalog the geometries or understand how to do that geometrization of physics better.
I was wondering if you could expand on the topological idea of the origin of electric charge, and I assume it's got something to do with the winding modes. Does string theory have to say about the origin of electric charge?
So, yeah, that really depends on it depends on the details of that geometrization, how you curl up the extra dimensions. So here's a very simple example. I'll write something on the board and you can tell me it doesn't make any sense or it does. But let's say, you know, what I said here is I had an extra dimension and I curled it up. Well, I want to describe physics in my string theory. So there's some geometry there. So I'm going to write down a metric. So that's just a matrix. But these indices run over lots of different directions, namely both the directions we see here, time and space. And so there's a part of that metric that describes the physics in this room. But then I said there's some extra dimension here, say some circle, and so there's a part of the metric that also describes this extra fifth dimension set. But if I'm going to fill out this, you know, this is a matrix, it's got components over here, so it's got components where there's both an index in our dimension and an index that's in the circle direction. But if I look at that, that's actually behaving like a vector. And what you may know is, well, I've written it in a very suggestive way, but that's a vector is the kind of object that we use to describe Maxwell's equations. This looks like the kind of four vector that appears in, electromagnetism. And so this is actually a very old idea. This is one manifestation of how charge emerges in string theory, but it actually goes back to ideas that were worked on in the 1930s. But it would say that this momentum that's running in the circle here of the particles actually becomes a charge in the four-dimensional physics. And that momentum, or the gauge, the thing that gives rise to the magnetic and electric fields is actually then a component of geometry. Of course, string theory has more than just this geometry, has more than particles. It's also got these winding modes. And so there are other fields around that would realize, or they would give rise to the idea that this winding number is also a charge. And different components in 10 dimensions of some other field would look like a thing that's giving rise to electromagnetic forces, but the charge would be the charge that I associate with the winding number there.
So are you saying it's a manifestation of the gauge field?
The gauge field becomes a part of the geometry field, or a part of the, I'd like to say it becomes a part of the stringy geometry in the case of these other fields, but we don't really know what that stringy geometry is. I mean, the way we talk about it is we have this, which is a very geometric thing, and then there are all these other fields. But there's an intuitive sense that that other stuff should be describing something more complex, some other kind of geometry, This is, if you like, classical geometry. I need some new kind of geometry. This is that new language I'm looking for. I need something to describe string geometry.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I had the prejudice that string theory couldn't really make any predictable, or couldn't forecast anything that might confirm its existence in some way. And so you're talking about LHC, and that it might be able to shed some light on multiple dimensions or more dimensions and so on. And so I guess my question is that kind of a solid expectation, or would string theory skeptics, at seeing whatever LHC might produce, you know, you'll say, aha, string theory, and they'll go, well, there must have been dust in the machine.
No, they wouldn't say there was dust in the machine. The experimentalists wouldn't publish if they thought there was dust in it, or that was a possibility. But you're certainly right that, you know, I can, there, you know, at the LHC, I can see manifestations of some kind of new particle physics. And there are a lot of creative theoretical physicists out there, and they could probably build, you know, having seen the result, they could build a new model of physics and, you know, describe the same kind of physics. In fact, that's one of the things I told you, is that different kinds of mathematics could describe the same physics. And so sometimes, you know, someone may be talking about extra emissions, and someone else may be talking about a complex field theory. But they're describing exactly the same physics. And so it really, so in that case, it would really come down to, at some level, aesthetics. Which theory is the simplest theory? Which theory gives you, in some sense, the simplest description of whatever physical phenomena you want to describe? Another way in which you might manifest string theory, though, I mean, another of my favorite ways which you might manifest string theory is with the observation of cosmic strings or cosmic superstrings. And these, again, are these, you know, if I had some string that was roaming around here, and it got caught up in the expansion of the universe, it would be stretched out until, you know, that's the universe was tiny here, so the string may have been the size of the universe, and so it's still the size of the universe up here, but that means that it's a string that's stretched across the sky, and that's what this graphic is supposed to represent. This was actually a candidate for what's called a lensing effect. So what they saw was two objects in the sky that had, you know, basically the same properties. And so what they thought that might be representing is that there's some object in the middle, and it had if it was a lensing experiment, had the right properties to be a string, the gravitational field would have drawn those two images together. But I have to say, you know, after this was sort of a low resolution image, people got excited. They went and looked at it with the Hubble Space Telescope, and what they found was, in fact, there are two very similar galaxies in that picture. They're not the same object, unfortunately. And so there are several ideas. One is, you know, this is a very ambitious project. We're trying. But it's certainly true that any of these things is going to be a long shot. You know, at some level, nature has to be gracious and present us with an opportunity. So we also have to be, you know, we have to work hard and really be creative and come up with good ideas. It's a tough problem. How do you get from the Planck scale down to whatever it is, 10 to the minus 17, 10 to the minus 18 meters? But maybe that's the wrong idea. Maybe we're supposed to be looking up in the sky. Maybe we're going to see strings out there, or some manifestation of strings.
Well, can I just ask something related to that? So my understanding is that there actually already has been one prediction of string theory that has been verified. And you related to sort of very, very hot Gregory Dennis experiment called a
So there's a segue into, oh, I happen to have some extra transparency here. But I have to say, it's really, I don't want to overstate it. I don't think it's a prediction. It certainly wasn't a prediction. But there is, I mean, if you ask me, what have I been working on for the past, what the heck have you been doing for the past few years? It's really been nothing related to what I talked about. Well, but I've been trying to work on connections between string theory and the real world, but again, it's in a very different way. And so what I've been working on is related to an experiment that's out on Long Island. It's called the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider. You go to Google Map, get a nice picture. This is the Brookhaven National Lab, and you'll see there's this big ring. And what they're doing is they're accelerating gold ions, or the nuclei of gold atoms, to very high energies and smashing them together at very special, inside very special detectors that have these fancy names here. Each one of those is about the size of the house. And when two of those nuclei smash together, you get a big bloody mess that looks like that. Literally thousands of particles come out of every one of those events. And so given that, there are three obvious questions that come to mind. Why the hell would you do an experiment like that? If I gave you some gold, you could probably think of better things you want to do. What the heck can you learn from a big mess like that? And why the heck would a string theorist be interested in that? And so this is actually another hour-long talk, but I'm going to tell you about it in 5 minutes. So why Rick? Well, we have this understanding of nuclear matter. We, you know, I had this standard model, and I was zooming in on nuclei, and we found protons, neutrons, we found quarks. But in fact, what's holding that all together is the strong force, or what's also known as quantum chromodynamics, or QCD. This is an extremely rich theorist an extremely rich theory, and theorists have sort of explored QCD to a great extent, and they predict that there's some huge interesting phase diagram like this. And what we see typically in nature is just this little corner where we have nuclei, but if we go to very high density, as we might see in neutron stars, we'll get strange new kinds of superconductors. We go up there to very high temperatures, as we might see in the early universe, we would see, you know, perhaps new phases of QCD as well. In fact, I'm supposed to get this thing called the quark-gluon plasma, where I have these quarks and gluons roaming around freely. So what Rick is doing is it's smashing these guys together and raising the temperature up here, so we're trying to
they are trying to probe physics that might be physics in the very early universe. And they discovered something very, very interesting. They discovered that I don't just get a plasma in the sense that we usually think of it, namely where I have perhaps protons and electrons wandering around, but we get something here that looks like a liquid. So how can you, this brings us to the question, how can I tell, you know, what can I learn from that big mess? The idea is, well, when I said that I'm smashing things together, what naturally comes to mind is I have two things and I smash them head on. Turns out in this case, what's more interesting is when you smash them together but not head on. And so what happens is there's a sort of football shape, or North Americans can appreciate the football shape. Outside of North America, we call this an almond-shaped region, where the nuclei really overlap, and I form this high-temperature nuclear matter. The rest of the stuff goes screaming on down through the accelerator. But if I have a plasma in this shape, what it's going to do is it's going to start expanding. Essentially, it explodes. And so there are various possibilities. If this is just a free gas, a particle, the stuff just flies off in every direction, and it produces particles in my detector that are uniformly distributed around the axis of the beam. So that would be sort of that axis here. On the other hand, if it was a liquid, then things would flow together. There'd be what's called a collective flow, and pressure gradients would become important. So this would be, I'd have a blob of something at very high pressure in the center, But there's a bigger gradient in this direction because it's a smaller distance than in this distance. And so it just pushes more stuff out the sides than out the top. And so you can go to your experiment. You can just measure. Do I see an uneven distribution? You know, I had thousands of particles. I can do some kind of statistical analysis and see what's the distribution of those particles. And in fact, what they find is that there's an uneven distribution of particles. And so there is some kind of fluid behavior. But the real surprise is that it's a near ideal fluid. So what does that mean? Well, it means that the viscosity is very small. A very quick reminder, what's viscosity? That's if I have a fluid and I've got different layers of the fluid flowing at different rates. There's a stress or a force that appears that tries to even out those gradients in the velocity. And so here what I said is there's more stuff, or there's an unevenness in the flow around the circle and around the axis here. And so if I had a big viscosity, what I'd find is that would even out this flow and try and make things more uniform. And so reduce this number, perhaps even eliminate it. And so what they found just in their measurement, well, you have to take the data. Then you have to run some complicated simulations to try and understand how those particles emerge from the detector. But what they find is viscosities that are characterized in this way, where I take the viscosity and divide by the entropy density, and that gives me just some dimensionless numbers. And what comes out is numbers of this order, 0.08, 0.16. Those sound like small numbers. So perhaps you can believe me when I say they're small, but in fact, they're smaller by at least an order of magnitude of the smallest viscosities that we're seeing in a laboratory. And this is an enormous challenge for the theorists to gain insight into this, because all of the standard tools that we have to describe this fluid just fail. They don't work. I mean, there are computer techniques, but they're not good at studying dynamics. There are perturbative techniques, but they're good for studying plasmas, but not a complicated fluid. So that was one of the surprises from the experiment. A surprise that came from the string theorist is, and it's not really a, it's, yeah, I have to emphasize, it's not a prediction, but in a parallel set of developments, the string theorists were studying, using techniques that came from string theory to study plasmas or fluids that were not quite the same as this QCD, but related. And what they found was a very elegant result, that this ratio came out to be 1 over 4 pi. And that's beautiful enough that I just look at that and say that's beautiful. But if I actually plug in the numbers, what I find is 1 over 4 pi is 0.08. Now look at that. So what we've got is a theoretical technique that allows us to study plasmas or to study theories and situations that are seem to be very closely related to the QCD plasma, and they're producing numbers that are of the same order. And so what I've been doing and what a lot of people have been doing, I mean, Andre Starnetz, he did this calculation before he came here, but Andre was one of our postdocs here in the string theory group. And he inspired a lot of us to start working on these kinds of ideas. And what I've been doing is basically to put these techniques, to put this relation between the string theory and perhaps the Rick physics on a firmer footing, and actually develop it into a point where you are doing, you know, quantitative calculations and making quantitative predictions for the theory. And one of the things to be said is that LHC, I mean, we talked about supersymmetry, large extra dimensions, but in fact, LHC has a detector that was built specifically to study this kind of physics. And so it's going to open up, a new energy frontier in QCD. And we're going to, you know, there's an opportunity there to learn amazing new things. But one of the things is that a lot of the naysayers in the nuclear physics community say that, well, at LHC, this number is just going to shoot up, you know, and we're going to see completely different physics. And so if the string theory model is correct, then this number will basically remain unchanged. And so there's a real tension there. You know, in a couple years, I could find that what I've been doing is, you know, put it in the recycling bin. On the other hand, if, well, that's not entirely true. At a theoretical level, I will have learned new things, but it won't be new things about nature. No, I'm always looking to develop new tools, new mathematics as well. But it could be that all those naysayers are wrong, and it could be that we see values of 8 over s that are coming out at about the same, and then we'll still be in the same position where basically the string theories have techniques where these calculations are very simple. But on the other hand, you know, the standard techniques, well, what's interesting is the standard techniques will be moving closer and closer to regime where they can, at least the perturbative technique, when you work really, really hard, can also be applied. And you might see a merging of the ideas coming from string theory and the ideas coming from sort of more standard approaches to this problem. There's a lot more that I could say about that, but I'll just leave it at that.
Can stay for a few more minutes after
anyone
has any questions. But we will take, before we go, so first of all, thank you very much for the presentation. Just a small. So we'll have a 15-minute coffee break. So we'll come back here at exactly 11.